This is number 0016, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0016. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we talk to Renee Ashton, author of How to Stop Hating Your Ex So You Can Co-Parent in Peace. What made her write this book?
I have a 8-year-old daughter, and when she was born, I didn't like her dad very much. You could say I hated him, but I didn't know how not to hate him, and I vowed not to be like my parents and have a terrible, ugly custody battle back and forth, and that's exactly what I was doing, and I didn't know how to not do it, so I figured it out along the way over 3 years and wrote about it and turned it into a book.
We'll also meet Tank Black, who went from a high-powered sports super agent of big names on the field to a convict who spent 8 years behind bars for a Ponzi scheme that he wasn't guilty of.
It was a new beginning. I had, owned a company worth over $100 million, and I seemingly was on top of the world and could get anything I wanted anytime, pretty much. And it was just a situation where, even though I had gotten cleared 4 years later of this fraud involving my players and this whole Ponzi scheme business, by then the government had pretty much taken everything from me. And so it was a whole new beginning and start all over again, if you will.
We have book banter with Stuart Nullman.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, with a review of the biography of the man behind the goalie mask, Jacques Plante, plus some other recommended reading for the rink, and that's what's coming up on Book Banter.
And Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
I'm hot under the collar and I'm getting hotter all the time. Actually, that's not true. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation and the temperature this week. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here, on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And our guest later this week is Steve Patterson, who is a comic and host of The Debaters on CBC Radio in Canada. He's also the host of the Just for Laughs radio show on XM Satellite Radio, a show, by the way, that I happen to produce in this very studio. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the slate for us on the program. And of course, we have lots and lots of stuff in the Stuff File program, so let's get right to it. I was trying to get through this program and through this week without talking about Tiger Woods, but apparently that's not possible. So here's my Tiger Woods story for you for the Stuff File program. The transgressions of Tiger Woods have proved too much to take for one of the golf superstar's most fanatical fans, who is now disbanding a church that he set up to praise the sports icon. John Ziegler, the pastor of the First Church of Tiger Woods, which is at www.tigerwoodsisgod.com, has announced in a statement on the blog that the organization is being dissolved because of the golfer's personal sins. The church, whose homepage has now been rechristened the Damnation of Tiger Woods, was launched by radio host Ziegler, well, you can't trust radio hosts, back in 1996 to celebrate the emergence of the true Messiah. However, the lurid revelations that have swirled around Woods since last week have left Ziegler so disenchanted that he's now ending his church, which has its own prayer for Tiger and 10 Tiger Commandments. After several days of evaluation, I have decided to disband the First Church of Tiger Woods, Ziegler wrote. Tiger is clearly no longer deserving of being seen as a role model or a hero, and he has needlessly squandered his unique potential to be a positive force in our country and the world. While I'm relatively sure that Tiger will make a comeback from this sad episode and that there will be great moments for him in the future, I personally am done with Tiger Woods. However, Ziegler's reaction appears to fly in the face of the 10th of the Tiger Commandments, which is, thou shalt not pay attention to Tiger's apparent flaws. Okay, I gotta say something about this story and this guy. First of all, Tiger Woods now has something in common with baby seals. Apparently they're both being clubbed by Norwegians. But If you started a church to Tiger in the first place, you have issues. Tiger is probably going to go down as the greatest golfer ever. And I don't care what he does off the links. That's between him and his wife. So if you're having a church to Tiger Woods, all I can say is get a life. There was no reason to worship him in the first place. But I digress. Let's move along. Let's stick with the church in a more romantic kind of way, shall we? And talk about Facebook while we're at it. Facebook has become so popular, it's now even invading wedding ceremonies. When Dana Hanna married Tracy Page, the minister had just pronounced the couple husband and wife. But before Dana gave his bride, his new bride, the traditional first married kiss, he whipped out his BlackBerry and updated his Facebook status to married. He also tweeted, "Standing at the altar with Tracy Page, where just a second ago she became my wife. Gotta go, time to kiss my bride." The audience burst out laughing as the minister, who by the way was in on the stunt, told them that the groom was updating his relationship status. Dana then handed his phone to Tracy so she could update her Facebook status. A clip of the stunt was also posted on YouTube, where it has already become an internet hit. Dana later admitted, "This was just done to be funny. We really don't Facebook that often." The first sign of denial is people who say that they really don't Facebook that often. By the way, my Facebook page is open right now. It's always open. You can find me on Facebook. My Facebook page is facebook.com/PA Holder. And speaking of Facebook, we go to Vienna for our next story. A 33-year-old furry photographer is winning fans on social networking website Facebook for pictures of her daily life as an orangutan in a Vienna zoo. The orangutan, whose name is Nanja, she takes her photos with a camera that dispenses raisins as she snaps and has won over 500 fans on Facebook since the zoo launched an online photo album. Although the slightly blurry images of Nanja's climbing rope, food, and companion's shaggy red-brown fur have all won lots of admiring comments from fans, the photographer herself is not so interested. Of course, the apes don't care about the pictures. They are just an accidental side product, says the zoo spokesperson. They just know that when they press the button, a raisin pops out. Well, isn't that the way it is with a lot of us? The zoo set up the project to keep Nanja and her three hairy ape friends entertained in their enclosure. You can find the album online at Facebook, and I put a link in on my website, so you can go to my website and find it for this program. Just check on the What's On page, number 0016, at thestufffile.com. Meanwhile, holiday stories, it's that time of the year. We go to Morrow, Georgia. A man dressed as an elf is in jail after police in Georgia said that he told a mall Santa that he was carrying dynamite. Police say South Lake Mall in southern Atlanta was evacuated, but no explosives were found. Morrow police arrested 45-year-old William C. Caldwell III, who was being held without bond in the Clayton County Jail. He was not part of the mall's Christmas staff. Police say Caldwell got in line to have his picture taken with Santa. Police say when Caldwell reached the front of the line, he told Santa he had dynamite in his bag. Santa called mall security and Caldwell was arrested. Caldwell faces several charges, including having hoax devices and making terroristic threats. Didn't anyone question why some guy was standing in line to meet Santa who was actually dressed as an elf? Anyone question that at all? Who was an adult, by the way? An adult dressed as an elf? That alone is just weird. But anyway, moving right along, we go to London for our next story. Gone are the days of shepherds in tea towels and tinsel-clad angels. I remember being in a Christmas pageant where I wore those items myself. Ah, memories. Britain's competitive parents are forking out on luxury pashmina shawls and velour dressing gowns to make their child the star of the annual nativity play. The rise in so-called manger chic has seen parents spend up to £150 on Arctic fur throws for children cast as sheep and ivory bridesmaid dresses for angels, according to department stores group Debenhams. The amount of money that some parents want to spend on their child's nativity play appearance would enable baby Jesus to leave the stable and check into a 5-star hotel, said a spokesperson by the name of Ed Watson. Intense competition for places at good schools, concern about the future state of the jobs market, and a drop in handcraft skills like sewing among time-pressed parents appears to be to blame. But Debenhams is keen not to encourage the trend. While we applaud parents for wanting to do their very best for their children, we feel certain that the story of the Nativity can still be told using very simple materials, Watson said. Well, really, when you think about it, isn't that the whole point? I mean, there's not a lot of riches going on back then in the biblical times, with the exception of, what, frankincense and myrrh, but I digress. Moving right along, we go to Texas for our next story. Since we're talking a little bit about religion, a Fort Worth area couple said one of their hens laid an egg with a cross on the end of it. Pam and Tracy Norrell of Burleson, who displayed the odd-shaped egg, said that they believe it's a sign of encouragement during the holiday season. And as I've mentioned on this program time and time again, the Lord does show up in mysterious ways. There's sightings everywhere. Tracy Norrell said he was gathering eggs one night when one of the ones he picked up seemed to be unusual, not smooth like other eggs. The misshapen egg had an indentation on one end with what appears to be a cross on it. The Norrells say eating the egg is not an option. Gee, can anybody say eBay? Burleson, by the way, is about 10 miles south of Fort Worth. Meanwhile, in Crestview, Florida, 48-year-old Donald Leon May entered an empty residence without permission and proceeded to take a shower. According to police reports, he entered the home through an unlocked back door. While in the shower, a boy, who thought his father was home, entered the bathroom and suddenly realized that it wasn't his dad. May told the boy that President Obama let him in and told the boy to leave. The boy went to a neighbor's house to call police. Police found May still in the house with nothing on but a towel wrapped around his waist. When questioned by police, May said the yellow brick road brought him to Crestview. He was promptly arrested. I'm thinking a psych evaluation is in his future. Moving right along, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, the holidays are quickly approaching, and that means family get-togethers, and for the most part, people are looking forward to these gatherings. But what about bringing together people who have been involved in a breakup? Renee Ashton is an actress and writer based in Los Angeles, and she has written a book out of necessity. It's called How to Stop Hating Your Ex So You Can Co-Parent in Peace. She joins us on the line from L.A. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Peter. Hello, everybody.
Thanks for being on with us. So, as I said in the introduction, you wrote this book out of necessity.
Oh, yes. It was much, much needed. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and when she was born, I, needless to say, didn't like her dad very much. You could say I hated him. But I didn't know how not to hate him, and I vowed not to be like my parents and have a terrible, ugly custody battle back and forth, and that's exactly what I was doing, and I didn't know how to not do it, so I figured it out along the way over 3 years and wrote about it and turned it into a book after it worked for me.
Now, it's interesting because there are, as you know, just about a book for everything out there, but you wrote this book because you apparently couldn't find what you were looking for to answer your own questions?
No, there wasn't. There was plenty of things on the kids going back and forth and custody as far as like terms of days and schedules and money and things like that. But there wasn't anything about the emotional part of dealing with or how not to deal with the fighting part of your ex in front of your child or bad mouthing your ex in front of your child or anything like that. I couldn't find it and I didn't know how not to do it. So I was like, okay, I'm going to figure it out. I don't know how I'm going to figure it out, but I'm going to do it. So that's how the book came about.
What would you estimate was your biggest stumbling block in the relationship or lack thereof with your ex?
I would say the hardest part probably was admitting my part of it and then moving past that. Because, you know, it is a blame game typically, but I knew that if I do what my parents did and blame the other person, I wasn't going to get anywhere. So I thought, okay, well, how am I going to take responsibility for this? Because I'm nearly perfect, Peter, and barely did anything wrong. So that was really probably the hardest part was taking responsibility for my part of it and knowing that I had to change it. I couldn't change him. I could only change myself to change the situation. And that was pretty tough to do.
You mentioned you went through this as an adult with your child, but also you went through this with your parents, correct?
Correct. They've been divorced since I was in fifth grade or something, and to this day, they still won't be in the same room together. It's crazy.
Well, I was about to ask, have your parents read your book, and have they learned anything from it?
Actually, they did. Both of my parents read it and called me and apologized. They said, on page 9, you said, I did this. I'm sorry. On page 12, whatever, I did this. And, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't even realize that it impacted you that much. Or, yes, it definitely did.
Now, your daughter, you say she's 8, correct?
Correct.
So I'm guessing she's a little young to read this book. But do you anticipate one day that she will read this book?
She very well may, and knowing that day could come, that is why I didn't put a lot of the things, the negative things that her dad did in the book, because it's really not about blaming him for what he did or pointing the finger and say, you know, he did this, or I don't even want her to know the things that he did. So I actually purposely kept those things out of the book, because if she ever does read it, which she may one day because she does know about the book, I don't want her to think that, I don't want her to think any less of her dad, because he's a great dad and he loves her very much.
What does your ex have to say about the book?
You know, I gave him the book and I said, I'm going to move forward with this being published and I'd like you to read it. And if there's anything that you don't want in there, please let me know. If there's anything that you have a problem with, please let me know. And he didn't come back with any problems, anything.
What would you say, who would you say has a better relationship, you and your ex or your parents?
Oh, for sure, me and my ex. We get along great.
Well, that's good.
Now we do.
That's good. So I alluded to, again in the intro, that the holidays are fast approaching. For you guys in the United States, you just had Thanksgiving, which is a big gathering holiday as well. So what are some tips for people who have, you know, Hanukkah and Christmas coming up and other holidays and lots of family get-togethers? What do you say is some of the things they should do as far as tips are concerned in dealing with an ex?
I know this sounds so obvious, but you have to put your kids first. And that means you have to love your kids more than you hate your ex. And if you can do that, you won't drag your kids and make them have a terrible holiday because they have to pick who they want to be with. You can allow them to go with who they want to be with, if that's possible. Or you can share the holiday together if that's what the kids want and you can fathom to do with the other parent for the kids' sake. It's really just about putting the kids first and seeing what they want and what they're capable of handling and what's best for them, not for you.
Well, let's put another fly in the ointment here. Let's go on the assumption that the kids want both of you together for the holidays, and you can manage to do that rather well. What if either one of you now has a new partner? Does that complicate the situation?
It can if you let it, but most importantly, if that's what the child wants and you can be around the other parent and you can get along with them and you can have a conversation with them or pretend to enjoy each other's company just for the child's sake, for that one meal, for those 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever it is, and there's another boyfriend or girlfriend or spouse involved, I think it's even better for the kid to see, you know what, my parents love me so much that they can spend this holiday with me with the other person and their girlfriend or boyfriend or their other kids or whatever it is. I mean, imagine how good that must feel for the child to feel that loved.
I checked your website, and the website, by the way, is howtostophatingyourex.com, and I think there's a very important point at the bottom. You mentioned the fact that you're not a psychologist, you're not a doctor, you're not a social worker, you're just a mom, and I think that speaks to a lot of people out there who are looking for this kind of information.
I guess I am just a mom, and I spent numerous hours with those people listed, because I thought, okay, a therapist can help me. Everything you can imagine. I went to spiritual healers. I went to hypnotists. I went to regular therapists. I went to non-traditional therapists. And nothing really, like, clicked for me. But I figured even if I could take a piece of everything that could potentially work and put it together in my own way and work through it, anything's possible. I just have to make the choice to be willing to do it, as uncomfortable as it may be for myself. Then it was.
When did the book first come out?
It came out, I think, 2 months ago.
Oh, so it's
on Amazon.
It's fresh, as they say. It's right off the presses.
Brand new, yes.
So just 2 weeks. I would have hoped to get it out a little earlier, just before the Thanksgiving holiday. Although it's just in time for Christmas.
Right? Yeah, and I'm sure people need it and can use it. It's a good stocking stuffer, I'm going to say.
And it by no means, by the way, is your first book. I said in the introduction that you were also an actress, but you've written other books as well, including Lights, Camera, You, Make Money Doing TV Commercials in Los Angeles, or Anytown, USA, correct?
Correct. I've been making my living doing commercials as an actor for 16 years. And people always come to me to say, how do I start? What do I do? And I've helped people over the years for as long as I can think of, because anybody can do it, and it's such a great, fabulous way to make a living. And I thought, you know what? I'm spending so much of my time helping people that if I just write this down, I could say, here you go, and you can read it, and then come back, and then I can guide you through the process a little bit more if I need to.
So it seems to be that everything you write comes out of necessity.
Correct. I wish I had my book when I first moved to Los Angeles.
Well, there you go.
I wish I had it, but I didn't.
Well, I hope that your life isn't so traumatic in the future that it requires that you write another book, that you'll just write another book if you want to. But this current one is How to Stop Hating Your Ex So You Can Co-Parent in Peace. It's written by Renee Ashton, and you can check out her website, which is howtostophatingyourex.com. I thank you very, very much, Renee, for taking the time to be on the program with us. Best of the holidays to you.
Thank you for having me, Peter, and enjoy yourself.
That's Renee Ashton, author of How to Stop Hating Your Ex So You Can Co-Parent in Peace. For more information, check out the website howtostophatingyourex.com. And you can find links to her website by going to mine. You can also find links to amazon.com and amazon.ca where you can order the book directly. TheStuffFile.com is the website. That's www.thestufffile.com. And again, go to the What's On page for program 0016. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Tank Black, author of Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. We'll also have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Steve Walsh is along, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff right here, right now. We go to Birmingham, Alabama. Court officials say a Birmingham woman who changed her name to Jesus Christ didn't live up to it when she reported for jury duty. The woman, previously named Dorothy Lola Killingsworth, was sent to Judge Clyde Jones's courtroom for a criminal case. Court officials said that the 59-year-old was excused because she was disruptive and kept asking questions instead of answering them. Efforts to reach Christ for comment were unsuccessful. Court administrator Sandra Turner said people there were shocked when the woman insisted her name was Jesus Christ, and some potential jurors laughed out loud when her name was called. But Turner said, unlike some Jefferson County residents, Christ didn't try to get out of jury duty and was perfectly happy to serve. Well, the Lord works in mysterious ways. Speaking of names, over here we call them potato chips. In Britain, they call them crisps. And one of the more popular brands is Monster Munch. They're obviously targeted towards kids, but 26-year-old plumber Chris Hunt loves them so much, he's legally changed his name to Mr. Monster Munch. Chris says he starts the day with a package of pickled onion Monster Munch, has a roast beef Monster Munch sandwich for lunch, and a flaming hot flavored bag for dinner. He said, I don't think my friends thought I would go through with it, but now I demand to be called either Monster or Mr. Munch. He is so obsessed with a snack that he's even devised recipes to include Monster Munch in rice and pasta dishes. And if you're worried about Chris's health, oh, I'm sorry, that's Mr. Munch's health, he added, I know it's a bit extreme, but I make sure I eat a balanced diet and I run 35 miles a week and train in the gym 3 times a week. So there you go, Mr. Monster Munch. Under the headline of Chutzpah, after James Cedar admitted to police that he was the one spotted peeping into his Toronto neighbor's window at night, the victim, Patricia Marshall, installed a video camera at that window to discourage him from reoffending. In September, when all parties reported to court for the final resolution of the peeping case, Cedar's lawyer served legal papers on Marshall, threatening to sue her over the camera. Since Cedar's house sits within the view outside Marshall's window, he complained that the camera could capture images through his windows and thus invade his privacy. Yes, that's the definition of chutzpah right there. And while we're on a crime spree here, 32-year-old Elena Aronson of San Francisco lived a real-life horror movie while riding a city bus to work. The man sitting next to her kept gazing at her teeth and told her, "Your teeth are so beautiful, like the moon and the stars." And then it got weird when he said, "I want them." Aronson, who grew up riding buses on the south side of Chicago and later in New York City, had never encountered anything like this before, so she decided to make a quick exit. The next thing she remembered was being on her knees outside the bus, bleeding profusely from her torn lip, with her two upper front teeth missing. There's a Christmas song there somewhere. A police took a report, but it was weeks before her memory returned. Even now, she doesn't remember the man following her off the bus or being hit, and no witnesses came forward to tell police about it. As a result, police aren't sure exactly what happened. A police sketch artist helping her came up with what she considers to be a dead-on image of the man who liked her teeth. Police are now looking for him. Hopefully, they'll find him, and they'll put him in jail. Let's talk about somebody who actually was in jail. Back in the 1990s, Tank Black was one of the most successful sports agents in the business. His clientele read like a who's who in sports. Then the trappings of success led him unknowingly into a Ponzi and money laundering scheme, and it cost him his clientele, his business, and his freedom. After 8 years in federal prison, Black is back to set the record straight. Years of writing in jail resulted in his memoir, entitled Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. He's on the line with us right now from South Carolina. Tank, how you doing?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you went from the heights to the depths, I guess, in the course of your career, all because of what happened to you. Let's go forward a little bit and talk about what was life for you when you got out of prison after 8 years.
Well, you know, it was just, it was a new beginning. I had, you know, owned a company worth over $100 million, and I seemingly was on top of the world and could get anything I wanted anytime, pretty much. And it was just a situation where even though I had gotten cleared 4 years later of this fraud involving my players and this whole Ponzi scheme business, by then the government had pretty much taken everything from me. And so it was a whole new beginning and a start all over again, if you will.
So besides writing the book, have you managed to get back into the business, or have you gone into another direction altogether?
I have pretty much gone into another direction. I can go into the business. I gave my license up for 3 years, and I can have it reinstated at any time. That reinstatement period started back in 2003. But now I've pretty much kind of gone in another direction where I want to be able to take this. I want to be able to use it to help young people and their families as it relates to understanding what really goes on in the game of NFL football and NBA basketball, and be able to help answer a lot of questions that they would have and give them some important things that they can look at to help their careers and not make some mistakes that other players have made in the past.
Now, despite the fact that you have been completely exonerated, as you mentioned earlier, and you're not going back into the business, when you hear what happens, especially now in this day and age with other Ponzi schemes and other big people going to prison who are guilty of their crimes, what goes through your mind when you hear not necessarily the crimes that they committed, but the vulnerability of those that the crimes were committed upon?
Well, no, you know, I invested in the Ponzi scheme that the government said that they thought I was involved in, which is kind of ridiculous, obviously, Peter. But, you know, you put faith in people and you believe that they're telling you that they're investing in a particular product, and then you talk to other people, whether it be friends and family members, about that product, and only to find out later that they didn't invest anything in it and that they're using that money for their own personal gain is devastating, to say the least. It was the worst day of my life when I found out that I had clients that I'd had for a number of years that invested in an investment that I'd invested in, and to find out that it was a Ponzi scheme and that money could potentially be completely lost. Now, that was a scary moment for me.
So again, when you see what goes on with what's happening today, the Bernie Madoffs of the world and the Enrons of the world, and the list goes on, and the same thing's happening here in Canada. Do you think about those people who have invested and the clients? Do you ever sit back? Because, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, people should be more aware of where they're putting their money. That sometimes it's the greedy who get caught, but it's more than that, isn't it?
Oh, it's way more than that. It's people having confidence in the investment procedures and the people who do invest in and people who have companies, and they're just simply being lied to, and that's against the law, and that's clear fraud. And the unfortunate part about, let's say, something like Bernie Madoff is that there were several instances where the SEC and the government should have been able to red flag that, but because of who Bernie Madoff was, they didn't deal with it.
Well, you know, let's take a look at some of the things you did as a sports agent, because that's another aspect of your past that's most interesting, and one of the things you talk about in your book called Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. One of the things that you have to deal with as an agent when you're dealing with professional athletes is the egos of professional athletes. Was it like sometimes corralling bulls when you had to deal with some clients and some owners?
A better term would really be a babysitting. I would call it high stakes babysitting in many cases, where you're getting paid an awful lot of money to be able to simply babysit certain issues for certain players. Now, a great many players, you didn't have to worry about babysitting because they just want you to do the job that they needed, and they wouldn't ring your phone off the hook. And as one of my closest people in my life says, blowing their phone up, they weren't doing that. And so, but that's what you're doing. You know, you're doing a lot of little menial things many times that that players should be able to take care of themselves, but they want you to take care of them.
When you look at, again, the publicity that a lot of sports celebrities get, and I'm not going to pick any names out of a hat. You can throw names in if you want. But when you saw some of the press that some players got, good, bad, or indifferent, are you more understanding of those situations, or is it a situation where sometimes these players get the bad rep they deserve?
I think that most times, I think players get the bad end of the media stick. I think that because they're out in the public's eye, I think that they're looked at much more closely under a microscope. But Plexico Burress is a great example, I think. You know, what he did certainly was wrong. But the normal person who would have actually done that, I feel, and actually shot themselves, and it wouldn't have been that media circus, of course, we know that, and probably wouldn't have been this type of severe punishment, except for, once again, it was under the microscope.
Do you think that sometimes sports athletes, because they are put on a pedestal by the general population and certainly kids, that sometimes they do have to pay a higher price when they do wrong?
Well, I know that they have to pay a higher price, whether I think that they should have to or not. I think that they should understand going in the door, and people should make it very clear to them that whether it's fair or not is not it's not relevant. The truth is you're going to have to pay a higher price if you go out and do certain things because of the fact that you're in the public's eye.
You just brought up a very good point that somebody should tell them in the beginning. Is part of the problem when kids come out of, depending what sport it is, college, be it basketball or football, that a lot of times in their college world, they are the big fish in a small pond. And to enter the arena on a world stage professionally, their head just isn't ready for it, and someone should be telling them what to do. And is that the job of a super agent or somebody else?
I think it's the job of a super agent, along with other people who are close to that player. Vince Carter, who played at Toronto, of course, for a number of years, is a great example, and talk about it in the book. You know, he had a situation that came up with a young lady that he got pregnant. He didn't want anybody to know about it. And so he wants me to go to Toronto and really take care of the problem, and which I did. But it's a prime example of a superstar athlete getting involved in something that it has no business getting involved with and not handling it very well, and then calling somebody else to be able to take care of the issue for them. And, you know, you can get a book at thetankblackstory.com, Peter. It's in the bookstores, but the best place to order the book is get it at thetankblackstory.com, and you get it in 3 days.
Excellent. So you've had a chance to deal with a lot of clientele. Again, there are egos involved. Is there ever a situation when you have clashing egos amongst your own clientele?
Yeah, you do have that. You have, I had 75 premium players, okay? And so when you have and over 35 first-rounders. So if you have that situation amongst, let's say, that many football players and Vince Carter along with that, then you're going to have some players that they're clashing because they feel like, well, you know, Tank is spending more time with you than he is with me, and your issues seem to be more important to him than they are to me. Of course, it's my job to make everybody's issues of primary importance. But sometimes the players don't necessarily look at it that way, and there are jealousies that exist between them.
The book is called Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. Who exactly did you write the book for? Was it somebody who wants to become a super agent, somebody who wants to know the inside of sports, someone who wants to know?
I wrote it for people because I want people to know what really goes on behind the scenes.
Right.
I wanted to write a book that I could write and not be worried about whether or not I was going back into the agent business or whether or not what somebody was going to say about the truth of the matter. And so I'm able to tell a story that most people wouldn't be able to tell. And I want people to know what really goes on behind the scenes in the sports business and some of the crazy things and some of the drama that really takes place. And this book is a great example of that.
Now that some time has passed and now that you have written the book, would you ever think of going back?
Well, you don't ever say never. You know that.
Right.
That would be my base answer for that. But that's not where my mind and my focus are right now. Right now, Peter, we have a situation where I've done a special edition of the book, an Angel Tree special edition, the word that we're trying to help Angel Tree. They give gifts to kids during Christmas time of prisoners, and along with a message from Jesus Christ. And so we're using the book to be able to help reach those 50,000 kids that don't have a sponsor. So every time somebody buys a book between now and Christmas, monies get donated to those kids.
Excellent.
So
and what's
those are the kind of things that we're trying to do right now.
Excellent. What's the best way to get the book?
Just go to thetankblackstory.com and order it.
Thetankblackstory.com is where you can get the book, and the book is called Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. I thank you very much, Tank, for being on the program with us.
Hey, I appreciate it, Peter, and I'd be glad to get on your show anytime you'd like to have me.
Tank Black, author of Tanked, Behind the Scenes with the NFL's Biggest Stars by the Game's Most Infamous Super Agent. If you go to my website at thestufffile.com, you'll find links to Tank's website and links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You'll find the links on the What's On page of my website in the show with the corresponding number. In this case, it's show number 0016. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Book Banter is next.
It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart's right here with us once again for another edition of Book Banter. How you doing, Stu?
Well, I think there's a little chill in the air right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know what that means.
Cold and flu season?
H1N1? That's two of them, but also hockey season.
Hockey season,
yeah,
yes.
And this edition of Book Banter, we're going to get a hockey book. Because if the weather was warmer, I'd do a baseball book. But we're going to do hockey this time. Jock Plante, in particular. You know, it was 50 years ago that a slap shot forever changed the face of how the goaltender played the game of ice hockey. It was November 1st, 1959, in a game between the New York Rangers and the defending Stanley Cup champion Montreal Canadiens. And Jock Plante, the Habs superstar goalie at the time, got the receiving end of a mighty slap shot courtesy of the Rangers' Andy Bathgate. The impact of the shot on Plante's unprotected face sent him flat on the ice with an ugly gash across it. Now, after he got patched up and a short conversation with Coach Toe Blake, with great reluctance, Blake suggested that Plante use the fiberglass mask that he used during team practices to go back on the ice. And that didn't hurt his sharp goaltending skills, as everyone feared, because after he returned to the game, he stopped 30 more shots and basically was part of a 3-1 Habs victory. Now, this great figure in hockey goaltending is the subject of Todd Deneau's biography, which covers the controversial career of the NHL goalie that spanned 20 years and five teams. And besides the innovations that he introduced to the goaltending position that's still being used today, like the mask, leaving the crease during the game, and the two-goalie system, it also shows that off the ice, Jacques Plante was his own man. He preferred to knit toques and socks, bone up on his goaltending skills, or read books rather than being part of the close-knit camaraderie that was the Montreal Canadiens in the 1950s. Now, another strength of the book is how Deneau not only tells the story of Jacques Plante, the goalie and the man, but also how the world of professional hockey in general and the future of the Canadiens in particular changed around him. I interviewed Deneau a few weeks ago, and he told me that the story of Jacques Plante is in tandem with the evolution of modern hockey. I mean, he was around with the era of the C-form professional contract, the birth of hockey games being broadcast on TV, the expansion of the NHL, and the introduction of the NHL draft. Basically, he was along for the ride. And also, this book is a very well-rounded portrait of the legendary goalie-cum-renegade, whose sole purpose was to improve and expand the role of the goaltender inside and outside the crease. It's rich in detail and well-complemented by thorough research, and it's a fine tribute to the man who combined his love of hockey, his passion for goaltending, and a piece of molded fiberglass, which has forever set the standard for netminders around the world for years to come. And it all started with a slapshot to the face on November night in 1959. So that's Todd's Deneau's book on Jacques Plante, published by McCullough and Stewart, and it's $32.99.
It's interesting. I saw a recent interview with Glenn Hall talking about how much it used to hurt being a goaltender before the mask days. And he wasn't even one of the first goaltenders after Plante to put the mask on. As a matter of fact, he was one of the last.
Yeah, one of the last, along with Gil Borsley and Johnny Bauer.
Exactly. And it's you think about it today and you think, who would ever think of doing that?
I mean, yeah.
Wow.
I know. Deneau told me that if Plante didn't put on that mask, it would have shortened his career dramatically.
Yeah, excellent.
You know, and if you want to read a little bit more,
yes,
about the Canadiens in particular, Lines in Winter by Chris Goines and Alan Turowitz,
uh-huh.
Excellent book, one of the first to really dig deep in the history of the Montreal Canadiens, and also any book that the Hockey Hall of Fame has put out with Andrew Podniak about, particularly about the members of the Hall of Fame, history of the Stanley Cup, and a new book on the contributions to Team Canada in the Olympics. Excellent books that you can read more about.
Excellent. So again, the book we just talked about today is called
Jacques Plante by Todd Deneau, published by McCullough and Stewart, and it's $32.99.
And speaking of reading, where can people read what you do?
Well, you can read me every week in the West End Times, online as well at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman and another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, now heard on CyberstationUSA.com and also World FM in New Zealand.
You're listening to the Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@peteranthonyholder.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Arino?
I'm happier than you can possibly imagine. Sleigh bells, are you listening? Okay, I'll stop. Hey, it's a wonderful day. We actually had a bit of snow here in the last few days. No, it didn't accumulate or anything, but, I mean, just looking outside and seeing snowflakes reminded me of a time when I was growing up, back in the true north, strong and free.
Right.
Yeah, when we had snow. Except the difference back then is we didn't just have snow for a half hour and it went away. We had snow for, half a week, and then it never went away. I like this better.
I don't mind the snow. Although we haven't had our snowfall yet, anything to stay. We had snow the other day as well, too, but nothing to stay yet.
Yeah, we won't have ours. I'm hoping this is it for the season. Yeah.
Well, now that we've got the climate report out of the way.
Of course. Yes.
What do you have for us this week, sir?
Oh, let's see here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Dateline, Sedalia, Missouri.
That'd be the show-me state.
I live here, you know.
Yes, I know.
Yep. A man covering his face with a bandana attempted to rob a Sedalia store using a toy gun. According to police, the man had his hand in his pocket as he demanded money from the clerk, who refused to give up the cash from the register. The suspect then pulled a toy gun with an orange stopper in the barrel from his pocket. Yeah, this isn't going to work out well, you can tell that. The clerk refused to give him any money, and the man, who had set a soft drink on the counter, then returned the beverage to the store shelf and said that if it weren't for bad luck, he wouldn't have any luck at all. He then got out of the store like a bat out of Hades. That was it. He left.
Poor guy. Yeah, right.
Yeah. A toy gun. Come on. Show a little nerve. Jeez. Dateline, Iowa City, Iowa.
That'd be the Hawkeye State.
A neighbor of where I live.
Mm-hmm.
Not Hawkeye, it's the state.
Yeah.
Iowa City police arrested 57-year-old Robert E. Lee.
No.
For treason. No. for allegedly dropping his pants at a CVS pharmacy and defecating on the floor before walking out. When police talked with Lee, they said he smelled of alcohol, no kidding there, had unsteady balance, no kidding there,
yeah.
And his speech was slurred.
I think there was more than a smell of alcohol.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Turns out he had a blood alcohol content of 0.24. That's three times the legal limit in Iowa. He was charged with fifth-degree criminal mischief and public intoxication and for leaving a mess in the corner. Anyway, okay, they didn't charge him with that. But they could have and they should have, okay?
Well, at a pharmacy, you can find toilet paper.
I don't think he was really worried about whether toilet tissue, as we like to call it, was available.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Dateline, Marion, Iowa.
That's still the Hawkeye State.
We're staying there, you know, because let's face it, the other story was so crappy. Police in Marion and postal authorities are investigating the case of a mail carrier, as opposed to a female carrier. No, a mail carrier who was allegedly found drunk inside a residence while on the job. Police said the postal worker was charged with public intoxication after she was found, notice I said she was found, sitting on the kitchen floor of this 95-year-old woman's house, eating leftover noodles from the woman's refrigerator. The police officer in the case, his name is Steve Etzel, he said the woman apparently entered the home through an unlocked front door. He said she was in uniform and had mail and a mail-carrying bag with her. But you know what? She didn't deliver.
Okay,
so, you know, people make jokes about going postal.
Right.
This ain't it.
I got you.
No. Dateline, Madison, Wisconsin.
That'd be the Badger State.
Or as we like to call it,
the Cheese State.
Where the motto is,
if it's cheddar,
it's better. Urinating on a... There seems to be a theme here tonight. Have you noticed?
I've noticed.
Drunkenness and relieving oneself.
Yes.
Yeah, urinating on a house and grabbing a piece of chicken off a grill proved to be the downfall for two Beloit men arrested in downtown Madison. They weren't only Beloit men, they were ignorant men. But anyway, I digress. Richard Carrot, who's 40 years old, and his friend Matthew Matthew McCartney, who's 38, were charged with operating a vehicle while intoxicated.
Of course.
Three drunk stories in a row. What are the odds?
Yeah.
100%, I guess. Madison police said the two stumbled out of a van in front of a house where a 22-year-old Madison man was grilling chicken outside. The two apparently were in need of a bathroom, but the grilling man refused to let them inside the house and instead went inside himself and locked the door. He looked out a window to see one of the men urinating on his house. So when the man finished, he grabbed a piece of chicken off the grill, and the two of them drove off. The colonel would never put up with this, okay?
No, he would not.
Man, the nerve of these people.
The gall.
The gall.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Dateline, Andersonville, Tennessee.
That'd be the Volunteer State.
Yeah, another one of my neighbors here in this part of the country.
Yep.
A man in Andersonville called for the sheriff when he heard a burglar in his house. By the time deputies arrived, the burglar had fled, but officers followed footprints to a nearby farmhouse. When they knocked at the house's bathroom door, another bathroom reference, same terrible things happened. The suspect was hiding inside, and he dove headfirst through the bathroom's second-story window. Deputies ran downstairs to find Larry Stephen Moore II lying face down in the dirt, and they called for an ambulance. Moore, who was wearing only thong panties and a woman's lingerie top, was not seriously injured. He was booked on burglary charges and for looking so bad in that costume.
I bet Larry Stephen Moore I is oh so proud.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he is. If that happened to anybody I know,
yeah,
I'd really be angry.
I can tell, yeah.
And, in fact, I'd be so angry I might do something. In fact, now, in my case, when I'm angry, you know what I do.
Yeah.
I put keyboard in hand and write a two-minute tirade.
I hear you.
And I'm heated up, so I'm going to write one tonight.
Okay.
Here we go, Peter. This is my two-minute tirade, and you've heard me complain about things before. This time, I want to complain about people missing the point. Even if they are right, from a legal perspective, allow me to elaborate. It recently came to light that alleged scientists at the United Kingdom's University of East Anglia Climate Research Unit, a major backer of global warming hysteria, or should I say climate change hysteria, have been emailing each other with the emails exposing a conspiracy to hide information that might discredit their claims. In essence, it might expose the whole global warming issue, or should I say climate change hysteria, is little more than a hoax. This is big stuff, folks, because the global warming, or climate change, advocates have been described by critics as holdover lefties from the 60s and 70s who want to hurt capitalism and what we like to call the American way of life. They can't sell that notion, but by claiming the polar bears are dying, they think they have a fighting chance. By the way, science, real science, shows the polar bear population is actually increasing. But why would these loons want the facts to get in the way of their hysteria? And as for those great scientific minds claiming the world is getting warmer, well, let me tell you something. Many of them are the same ones who, in the 1970s, claimed that we were headed for another ice age. For the record, science, real science, shows the Earth's temperatures have either steadied or declined every year since 1998. But again, why let the facts stand in the way of a good lie? Oh, as to my original complaint, people missing the point? Once caught with their hands in the email jar, they cried long and loud about how they were violated by someone who hacked into their emails. You know what? They're right. The person who hacked into the emails broke the law and should have to answer for that. But it doesn't change the fact that what has been exposed is an effort on the part of some to conceal the truth, to further a hoax, which far too many of us are willing to buy into.
Okay, so what I want to know, Steve, is...
I'm heated up right now, I'm telling you.
What I want to know, should I buy a heavier coat? That's all I need to know.
No, but I think whatever you're doing, whatever you have been doing for the past few years, let's put it this way. Don't think it's going to be okay in Montreal, Canada, to walk around with a thong bikini in January.
Never crossed my mind.
Okay. But if you know a good-looking woman who wants to, hey, give her my number.
I'll give you the website that she can find you at.
Please do.
Which is www.missourinet.com. That's www.missourinet.com. I thank you very much, Steve, for being on the program with us. Say, once again, those three magic words.
Hit the theme.
This is The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of The Stuff File program. We have time for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
And normally The Idiot of the Day is not a group, but just a person. But this time I got to make an exception. I often talk on the program about the nanny state, which is Britain, and they like to intrude on laws and try to make things safer for everyone. Here's the latest. The Health and Safety Commission of Great Britain has spent, or should we say wasted, $500,000 on a two-year study that has determined that bowling alleys are a very dangerous environment for families. Yep. The so-called safety experts concluded that it was too easy for children or teenagers to run down lanes and get trapped in machinery that sets up the pins, even though there has never even been one reported case of this ever happening. The bizarre health and safety executive report also said that bowlers would be at risk if they walked along the 60-foot lanes to knock over pins by hand, even though there has never been one reported case of this ever happening. The commission considered ordering every bowling alley in England to put barriers across the lanes, but they were forced to admit defeat after realizing that bowlers must be able to see what they are aiming at. John Ashbridge of the 10-Pin Bowling Proprietors Association said he had watched HSC inspectors examining a bowling alley and found their attempts to detect possible dangers hilarious. The $500 study was initiated after a bowling technician was accidentally crushed by the machinery he was working on 2 years ago. Well, he was a worker. Big difference. So collectively, I have to say, why would the Health and Safety Commission of Great Britain spend $500,000 to do this? Because altogether, they're idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The website is thestufffile.com. That's thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H for those who haven't been paying attention, thestufffile.com. That's where you'll find information and links on our guests on the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding date and program number. In this case, it's program number 0016. Email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com and World FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.